ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Bridget Harris, the CEO and co-founder of You Can Book Me. And today we're going to talk about how to make freemium work for a SaaS product. This episode is brought to you by Balsamic Mockups. Balsamic Mockups is a rapid wireframing tool that helps you work faster and smarter. It reproduces the experience of sketching on a whiteboard, but using a computer. Making mockups is fast. You'll generate more ideas, so you can throw out the bad ones and discover the best solutions. Try it free for 30 days at balsamic.com. Hi, Bridget.
Hi, Jane. Hi, everybody.
Thank you for making the time today.
You're welcome. It's a big topic.
Great. So before we started the freemium thing, I'm going to ask you a few small questions so that we can learn about your persona first.
Okay.
So Bridget, what do you do for a living?
So I run a company with my husband, Keith, called You Can Book Me. We do online scheduling. So You Can Book Me is a booking tool that people use to manage their time when they're trying to organize meetings and schedule time with customers and clients. Usual sort of thing, you know, you send somebody a link and they choose a time and it goes into your calendar. So we've been doing that, running that application for the last 5-6 years, but we've actually built a number of products between us. So we've had a sort of a long history of trying to get products off the ground, freemium tools, and landed on You Can Book Me as a SaaS tool, which took off because of the viral nature of scheduling, because we'd been around the block quite a few times in terms of what we knew we were trying to achieve and what product problem we were trying to solve. And so in 2012, I gave up my full-time job. I was working in politics, and Keith went full-time as well, and we basically started to run the company from then, kind of, you know, with a determination and a commitment to make it succeed.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about those products that didn't make it?
Sure. Well, our first product that we built together was Tickboxer. It was an online survey building tool, and we built that in 2003. And we built a very successful product. It solved the problem of, you know, collecting survey responses and coming up with a report at what your survey respondents have said. It's that kind of thing you now would see that people would use Google Forms to do, or Typeform, or if really serious surveys are using SurveyMonkey and others that are going to give you kind of quantitatively valid results. So what we found in that space was that we weren't really simple and we weren't very complicated. And so as a result, the product wasn't going to go anywhere. So we pivoted, if you like, from that a couple of years after building it. And we got into building tools like When Is Good, which is a aggregate scheduling tool. So that does the job of finding a time when a group of people want to meet. And we built When Is Good, and we built a couple of other products along the way. But You Can Book Me was born from people who used When Is Good, who wanted the booking side of the tool. So we were the first company to build what is now quite a familiar interface, which is the grid interface for booking. And we built that mm-hmm. for When Is Good. When Is Good has that exact same grid interface. And people saw those slots and thought that they wanted to secure those slots for themselves, you know, that kind of mutually exclusive, as opposed to a time when a group of people can all make it. So we built You Can Book Me as an offshoot of When Is Good.
Yeah, that sounds like an interesting story. Mm. Can you tell us a bit more about your personal story? What did you do before starting on that venture?
So as I said, I had a job in politics. So my background, I've actually had quite a lot of different jobs, Jane. So I'm not really claiming to have, you know, it's that jack of all trades experience where in my 20s, I actually worked in film and television. I had a whole different career working in media. But I got into working in Parliament in the UK in politics in my mid-20s, and it went from there really. So I had a sort of 15 years working for MPs and ministers and in Parliament and local government. I did a lot of work around political leadership and democratic theory. Really enjoyed it, love the topic, sort of addicted to politics, but not myself interested in any kind of, you know, the kind of campaigning and policy development side of it is for me kind of a bit off topic. What I'm really interested in is the process and the process of how power is distributed and how decisions are made and how we are represented and that kind of thing. And alongside me was my partner, Keith, who was a software developer, and he was working for clients and contracts that were, you know, he was understanding much more about how he could put his own skills to building a web application that we could run. So between the two of us, we'd worked together on a lot of digital projects for my politics work. So we've worked on digital campaigns and websites and voter contact databases and that kind of stuff. So I had a lot of requirements that I wanted from Keith to build for me for politics. And essentially that working relationship evolved into us running a company together, which built these other products like scheduling and survey building. So we were bootstrapped. Everything that we've built together, we've built up over a long period of time. So, you know, we've had our own lives to live in the midst of all of that. And, you know, you have to find your income and work out what you're earning and what you can spend and so on and so forth, and whether you're making money and whether your product is working. So we did that over a long period of time. And as I said, it was only a couple of years ago that both of us felt confident enough that we were going to rely entirely on the income from You Can Book Me. And since then, we've built up a company. We have about 10 people working for us in our company. Well, sorry, it's 10 of us altogether. 8 people work for us. We're a remote company, so we're spread over the US and Europe, and we're in Bedford, north of London. So we've built a business out of, you know, quite a wide collection of products and projects and ideas and so on. So we're still interested in politics, and, you know, we still do other bits and bobs on the side, but you know, it's all come together now for me and Keith as a kind of very clear co-founders of this company and of this product.
Fantastic story. What does your typical day look like?
Well, it's very regimented in the sense that we've got kids, so they go to school and we've got to get them breakfast and do the lunches. And, you know, our day revolves around making sure we're at home for when they leave in the morning and when they come back in the day. And then me and Keith will often go to our office. So we have an office here in Bedford, but we also work from home or from coffee shops. So we've never really kind of particularly made our peace with the idea that we need to run a big corporate entity. So we like ourselves, you know, wandering around and finding the places that are comfortable for us to work. So that could be the kitchen table, or it could be a local coffee shop in Bedford. And we work through the day, and we obviously work with our colleagues in the US who kind of come online around 2 o'clock in the afternoon there in the East Coast, work with our customers, work on the things that we're doing on You Can Book Me. And then one of us usually clocks off in the afternoon to go and, as I said, be home. And then we basically start working again in the evening when we pick up where we left off and keep going. And you know, You Can Book Me is a 24-hour tool. We have no downtime, or at least any downtime is painful to us, and usually because something else horrible is happening to Google Calendar or whatever. So we're a 24-hour service, and we have customers all over the world. So we're never short of things to do and things to pick up on at any point of the day. And we're in a good pattern. I like the routine of it, and it gives us kind of a structure. And I think that, you know, I'm sure we might talk about this, but work-life balance is very hard when you run your own company. So for us to put some structure in the day gives us times when we're not doing You Can Book Me.
What kind of work do you do as a CEO? I mean, what kind of activities? Would that be writing posts, organizing marketing? I don't know, a dozen other roles?
So there's two aspects of my job. One is to lead on anything that we, you know, if we haven't hired somebody to do something, then I'm the person left doing it, essentially. So if we don't have anybody doing marketing, then that's my job. So anything that where we don't have somebody defined in that role, I'm generally taking care of it. Through the day, making sure that everybody's essentially happy and motivated and doing what they need to do. And they come to me when they've got problems or they need to discuss stuff, or I'm essentially kind of all ears and all eyes on everything, so I can keep a bigger picture of where we're going. So when most of my colleagues are spending their day on quite detailed work, and they're quite involved in you know, small projects to get things done, so they can, when they pull their head up from that, I'm there to help them see the bigger picture of how to prioritize and what to do next and what we're trying to do as a company. So that's all of my kind of day-to-day job and responsibility. But my the second half of my job is to always look ahead and to try to ensure that the company's positioned in the right way for 6 months' time. So particularly because we're growing, you know, that means making sure that we've resourced the product sufficiently. So if we know we're going to get X number of more customers every month, and we're going to get X number of users, more users every month, then that's sort of an infrastructure pressure. That's a pressure on customer success. That's a pressure on feature requests and things that we don't do that we've promised people that we have done. And so there's a whole series of things that we need to look into the future about to say, you know, we need to land in 6 months. And so often I'm telling people, right, we're going to be doing this. And they look at me kind of in surprise, because they think, we don't need an extra person, or what are you talking about? But in 6 months' time, once we've recruited, hired and trained and, you know, inducted that person, they're there at the right time when we actually needed them. And so I always feel that my job is always about looking ahead and see the things that I'm doing today that we have nobody else in the company to do, looking to see at what point do I need to hire somebody to do that job themselves directly, at what point do I need to make decisions financially for the business to keep things financially on track, and hopefully make good decisions. Don't always make good decisions, but that's the intention.
What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
That's a good question. I mean, in some ways, there's loads I enjoy most about my job. I think what I enjoy most about my job is autonomy. And this is a personal thing, in that I think that I am personally most fulfilled and happy when, and everybody in the company will agree with this when they hear it, you know, when I get to basically do whatever I want to do. I don't like being told what to do. And I think that's probably a feature of people who are entrepreneurs and who run their own companies, because there's always that tension, essentially, depending on how opinionated you are about what you think you should be doing. So I think that's what I enjoy most. I feel very autonomous. I feel very self-reliant. And so I like the fact that it's on me. I like the fact that, you know, the success of the company is coming down to decisions that I'm making, which obviously I can't carry out or make good decisions without the, you know, the work of the entire company and the entire team. So one of the things I work on a lot is collaboration and transparency. And so everybody knows, you know, what we're doing. So I'm not a dictator, but I do like being the one being responsible for making the decisions. I think I'm good at it, and I do enjoy it. The thing that I don't like most about the company is when I have to face up to the consequences of having made a mistake. Often this could be with, you know, sometimes mistakes that are financial are incredibly painful. So when you realize you've just basically wasted money, when every penny counts, and, you know, we're all working hard to make the money. So if I've made a decision that is has cost us, then I don't like that. But also particularly when it's about people, when we're managing people. So if I'm managing staff and for whatever reason things go wrong, or, you know, I have to let them go, or you know, there's an issue with how we are managing them, that's very stressful, because, you know, I'm always aware at the end of the day that the person I'm dealing with has their own perspective, their own, you know, sense of autonomy, their own interest in life, and, you know, and they're coming up against my priorities in the business and for the company, and it's not necessarily in line with their interests as a person. And I don't like that because I have very strong values about you know, working as a team and taking care of people, and the company itself should be part of a solution for people. And I hate it when it's not a solution, you know, when You Can Book Me as a company isn't a solution for a particular person. That's really tough.
What is your next big thing?
Well, after You Can Book Me. What do you mean?
Maybe you're personally, or something like grand plans for You Can Book Me besides your spectacular growth.
What is my next big thing? I think that the job that I'm doing right now is big enough. And I think that this is the big thing. You know, I'm not sort of trying to leap over, you know, high hurdles at a regular basis that get ever higher so that I feel like I'm, you know, getting to the top of an unreachable mountain for most people, and that's what's going to fulfill me. I don't feel that at all. I feel that building You Can Book Me as a successful company with, you know, a measure of success that I can share with other people is big enough for me, and that, and it's hard enough, and I think it would be it would undermine my ability to do whatever we're doing with You Can Book Me if I actually had a big thing sort of sitting around waiting to be done. This is the big thing.
That is such a great answer. I didn't even think about it, that next big thing or the next shiny object can actually distract us from our real big thing, which is your business.
Yes.
So let's talk about freemium. You Can Book Me is a scheduling tool which is intended for wide audience. It's pretty much self-served. How did you decide that it's going to be a freemium thing?
So good question. We didn't, if I'm being absolutely honest, we didn't sit there and do a thorough business analysis and, you know, survey of the marketplace and decide that this was a great thing to do. I mean, I can't say that. I can tell you what happened, which was, as bootstrapped entrepreneurs, as people sort of trying to build a product and get people to use it, our first interest, and this was not with You Can Book Me, this was with Tickboxer, our first interest was, are people going to use this? Is this a good tool? And I think that in the first early days, that's probably very, very common, because you don't know what your business model or your pricing model is going to be like until you you actually can prove that people want to use it. And then, of course, if they want to use it, are they going to pay for it? Now, I think that then after that point, when we got with Tipboxer, it was free because we only had two users, and we hadn't even thought about pricing. I think we'd imagined that we would get people to use it as a free tool and then pay for premium features. And I think that the reason why we always decided to do it that way, because that's what we did When Is Good, and that's also what we do with You Can Book Me, is because there's a very low barrier to entry. And I believe that that's a very good thing when you're trying to launch an MVP. People use it for free. Therefore, there's no friction to people starting to use your tool. You also have the kind of expectation, not unreasonable expectation, that you can ask them for support and feature analysis, UI type testing, and they can put up with bugs. So, so for example, for a long time we had our free version of You Can Book Me on an entirely different stack, so that we could roll out new code to the free people, and if it broke, then they complained and we fixed them, but they were the guys that found our bugs quicker than we could, you know, through regular QA. So there was lots of kind of brutal truths about what you can get away with on a building a tool in a quite scrappy MVP lean iterative kind of way if you've got free users, because they're not paying you anything. So it doesn't, you know, there's no contract there that you have to worry about. So that worked for a while, and I think that was one of our reasons why we did it. I think another reason was that the kind of tools that we built, the scheduling tools, are designed for a mass market. You know, everybody can use scheduling. And so it was something where, I think I'm being fairly anecdotal here, but my sense is that people think of it as a kind of a, it should be a free tool, that people think of like you have a Facebook page or, you know, anything where it relies on everybody getting their own profile. People don't think that they have to pay for something which is about their own personal profile online, you know, that you're giving them a page, any of those kind of, I don't know, do you pay for Medium? You know, any of those pages where you're supplying a service to say you can put your profile online. So I think that we had that sense that you can book me and when is good was being used by people who aren't necessarily going to expect to pay. There was no competitors in our sector at that time that wasn't doing a free version of the tool. And in fact, actually, as we launched, people like Google Appointments had tried to do their own appointment service, and that was entirely free. So, I mean, I think we're very spoilt with free software, to be honest, and I'm sure we can talk about this in the analysis. But it didn't feel like we were building something that was immediately demanded a price tag. Another reason was that it's a very easy thing to do if you're inexperienced and you're bootstrapping and you don't quite know what you're doing. Building a freemium tool gives you a kind of a way out all the time about features, or you can test things and you can decide, you know, what you're going for. And it was incredibly valuable at the beginning because it allowed us to grow really quickly. And to this day, free users still allow us to grow very, very quickly because we actually have, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands more people using our tool than we would otherwise have if it was just our customers. So it's a growth tool. And if you're bootstrapping and at the very beginning, when you're not quite sure of your brand or your persona or your segment or your marketing, then just to be able to plug in the fact that you're giving something away for free. And as a result, you can build in a viral loop that, you know, you get them to share it so they can get something free as long as they definitely share your tool, then it's a very low cost way of growing your tool. So I think that's really why we did it, because we were inexperienced. We hadn't built a sort of a business case for paid for software. We didn't think the tool we had built was really immediately obvious that it was paid for software other than the freemium model. We didn't have any other way of growing the tool other than giving it away for free. And it allowed us to iterate very quickly against our free user base and test and ask them to suffer the bugs sometimes as we built it.
I totally see the case. Freemium actually has a lot of these benefits that you mentioned. Virality when it's a client-facing product, ease of acquisition, and plenty of others. And how long did you stay on a totally free model before you introduced your first paid option?
I don't think for very long. I think that the free version, that's a good question. I think with When Is Good, we probably had a free version of When Is Good running for, I'll have to check, but it could have been 6 months before we introduced free versions, but premium features. But with You Can Book Me, I think we actually might have had paid for versions always. So because You Can Book Me was our second tool, we understood and knew what we were building. And basically we were building it for people who we knew would pay. So the free version wouldn't have been out for much longer. I mean, I think when we first charged You Can Book Me, it was very low. I mean, it was nothing. It was sort of something like £12 a year. So I think whatever people paid, it really wasn't very much. But I think, oh, that's right. It was 6 months. You had to, if you paid for You Can Book Me, you had to pay upfront for 6 months. And it was about £40. You know, it was about $50, $60. But then we very quickly, I think that was in the first year, that was in 2011. And then we very quickly changed all those prices. So there's nobody on any grandfathered into any early version of You Can Book Me Now. We changed the prices pretty quickly within about a year. So we kind of knew we were having to go towards a much more customer driven focus. Although it took us a long time to get to a place where I think that freemium isn't costing us more than it's gaining us. I think that we did a lot of early work with our free users that we wouldn't do now. And actually, I've said publicly sometimes as I reflect, I wish we had the experience to do more what MailChimp and Basecamp have done, which is you start off with a paid for tool. So you do have to grow more slowly, but at least the people you're dealing with are paying you. And then you introduce free at a later stage to amplify your growth, or accelerate your growth. Whereas we did all of our growth at the beginning, and basically managed to get loads and loads of free users that did cost us. So it's fine if it's a free ebook and everybody, you know, one download or 1,000 downloads doesn't cost you anything more. But for us, scheduling does cost us in customer support and in engineering. So it really does matter to us. Free software for a YouCanBookMe user is not free for us. We pay for it.
Absolutely. We've had a lot of discussions here too, because Tiny Reminder is also operating on the free plan, and it didn't start with a free plan. Mm-hmm. So the ultimate conclusion that we arrived at is that freemium postpones the monetization greatly. So if you want to make money, you're going to make more money if you charge from day one.
Exactly.
But you can grow way faster if you offer a freemium model.
I think that is exactly it. That is it. And as I said, even now to this day, freemium for us is still our major source of growth. So I'm not knocking it, but I'm just better understanding what it does for us and what that balance is. So I think that yes, with one you lose with one, you gain with the other, basically.
If that's not sensitive data, what percent of your customer base is on the paid plan as opposed to the total customer base?
I'd rather not really go into details about that because it's actually, sorry.
I knew it was sensitive.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really, the thing is, it won't mean anything to anybody. It doesn't really kind of gauge anything for anybody else, because I wouldn't even recommend the numbers that we've got. What I can tell you is that, We're profitable now, so we've reached a point where our paying customers, and we have over 10,000 paying customers, you know, are funding a tool which is returning over nearly a sort of 900,000 bookings a month. There's a good proportion of those bookings that are free bookings. So I think that in a tool like ours, where we have thousands and thousands and thousands of active users every month, but we also have seasonal users and, you know, churned users and users that then come back and people who use the tool 1 month and then they're moving around. So it's not really very helpful for me to say these are the actual percentages, because it doesn't really mean very much. What really matters to me as a metric is, are we profitable? And for a long time we weren't. For a long time, the number of free users that was, and sometimes we've had, you know, over 100-150% growth in a year. So sometimes we've had a huge influx of users. If the vast majority of them, and obviously the vast majority of them are free, are costing us in engineering and customer support more than we're getting from the paying customers, the job is get more money from your paying customers, or get more customers, or do less for your free. So we've been doing a version of that over the last 18 months, and the result is that we're profitable now. So it's whatever your proportions are. You know, for example, you could have 100 users, 99 of them are free, one of them is paying. But if one of them is paying you an enormous amount of money, then that's all you need. Do you see what I mean? But so it matters how much money the customers that you get pay you as a proportion of your free.
Yes, exactly. That was one of my questions. The first plan and the only plan that you have is quite low cost.
$10
a month.
It's
not like those, like, for example, there is a model where professional marketing tools, I don't know, BuzzSumo can be an example, and many more, they have a rich free plan, but whatever comes next is so expensive that only really professional people can afford it. Yours is not the case.
No, I mean, we switched our pricing last year to something which we felt was more fair for everybody. mean, pricing, interestingly, like as a kind of a corollary to free, pricing then becomes, you know, it's easy to give stuff away for free because then you don't have to talk about pricing. Because as soon as you start pricing, you're required to justify, you know, why you charge for something. And we used to have a traditional, it was a $16, $48 and $144 set of tiers. And in that you'd get, you know, 5 team members, 10 services, you'd have a whole kind of different range of features that we had stuck into each tier. Now, what we discovered was, as a tool like ours, you end up with, as you said, either a massive cliff edge for one person having to pay a lot, or a very large company that could be paying 10 times, managing to squeeze into one price plan. So what we did was instead switch to price per calendar, which works really well for us now. So if you're just one person, you've got one calendar, you get all the features. You don't have to worry about one specific, you know, aspect of the tool for $10. But if you have two calendars, then it's $20. And if it's three calendars, then it's $30. So if you're a team of 10, you'd be paying us $100. If you all have multiple calendars and there's 20 calendars involved, then you'd be paying us $200. And what we found is that fits, because large companies with big teams, you know, they stop thinking in terms of, they don't care about features. You know, they don't care that we find ourselves explaining, you know, why this plan had this set of features compared to that plan. They don't care about that. Large companies and large teams just want to use your solution. They just want to know how much it costs, and they want to know how we've come to that cost. And if they've got 200 people and it's $10 per calendar, they're like, great, I know, you know, they can do the mathematics in their heads. Whereas if you are a single entrepreneur or freelancer or just a small business, you know, you only have one calendar, it's only one time, and it's $10, then again, it's a fair deal. The only time it's not fair, when it feels painful, is super busy people who have five calendars, and then they feel like they have to pay $50 and they've got five calendars. But I sort of feel like, well, I'm really sorry you're losing out there, but you're obviously super busy. Is that because you're making loads of money? You know? Or is it because, or maybe cut down, maybe make your life more simple. Sorry, I mean, I know it sounds a bit harsh, but there's always going to be winners and losers out of a pricing point. And what was very painful was to see a company and a single business owner paying the same amount of money.
That sounds like a fair case. So exactly how that can be translated to other companies is basically a single plan of per user pricing, right? Which is quite low as opposed to other pieces of software.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see. One more topic is whole art of balancing what you include in your free plan and what you include in your paid plan. Is that the volume of bookings, or is that specific features that you look up, and how did you make decisions on those?
That is a very good question, because I realized a few years ago we had made some significant errors in this.
I'm all ears. I'm so ears.
So we got confused between building up the product and taking care of the business model. So for a long time, when we built up the product and we added in features, we added them into the free tool. We sort of kept a reserve of features for the premium and professional payers that we knew did work, like multiple calendars and long lists of services or multiple team members and stuff. But every time we added in, you know, a little kind of basket of features when we were building the product, it all went into the free for no particularly good reason, other than it was kind of the path of least resistance, because we just wanted to roll things out. And it has two effects. One is you end up with product bloat at a price point which is zero. So you're essentially giving away too much. And we started from the wrong point of view. So my advice would be, build a really good free version. Build a free product which just does what it says on the tin. Nobody's ever going to complain about it, and you don't have to negotiate with anybody about what it is. And then, as a second product, essentially build a paid for version of the free version. Don't try to build one product that you throw loads of features into and hope that somebody will pay at the top end for you know, one slice of it. So that's what we've been trying to do now as we've been rebuilding a lot of our engineering and our product, which is that we've been trying to separate out more and more what the free tool is. And the advantage to that is that then you don't have support on all sorts of features that aren't appropriate for free users anyway. Because if you like, somebody wants free software because they just don't want to invest any time thinking about their choice. People who spend money obviously take care, and there's a scale. So, you know, if you're asking them to pay £2.50 for a cup of coffee, they're not going to spend massive amount of time worrying about whether this coffee is better than that coffee. Maybe some people do, but you know, if you ask them to spend £1,000 on curtains, they're going to spend some time looking at which curtains they like. So you've got this scale. Now, asking people to pay money for software, they will spend some time investing, and they'll look at it as a choice of, well, how quickly could I switch if I don't like it? You know, how long-term contract am I obliged for? You know, what's the worst case if it goes wrong, if it makes a mistake for me, you know? And so they've got this sort of basket of interest, and one of them is price. So if you ask them to pay £150 up front, then they're going to probably think quite a bit about whether they make a choice of your product. If you ask them to pay £10, it's reasonably low barrier. So we have a lot of people paying us £10 who in the end don't carry on using the tool, but they don't see that £10 as a bad investment because they're trying to figure out whether it's right for them. Now, when it's free, what you end up with is a lot of people who don't make any choice at all. They just think, oh, it's free. So they sign up, they get going. Then they kind of essentially, if you've left them a forest of features to have to fight their way through, then they get exhausted trying to figure out what all of this does. So you kind of force them, that they didn't even want to do in the first place, force them to figure out all these complicated features, which they would have figured out had they paid you for that. Bizarrely, people are more willing to give you their time if they've just paid you. It doesn't make any sense if you think, well, it does make sense, but it's sort of...
It's
counterintuitive because they've paid for their... They're paying them... They respect themselves, their own time, when they've suddenly paid for it. When you've told them something is free, they don't respect their time, and then they just flounder about. They cost huge amounts in support and questions and going back and forth. And in the end, they sometimes end up hating you because you've put all of these little bear traps in their way that they weren't expecting to do. So that would be my advice. A free tool has to be simple to use. It has to be straightforward. It has to be buttoned down. Now, very reasonably, they can then come to you to say, well, it's not very good for free. You know, it's not a very good tool. And you go, well, the paid for tool's much better. You know, sort of, that's the point. It's not trying to be a bait and switch. It's trying to be can you use this tool reasonably easily without bothering anybody? Because people who use free software don't really want to be bothered by people. So I think that was our biggest lesson, and we're still learning it. You know, that's still we're not at that stage just yet, but that's our objective, that's our aim, is to get to a very simple free tool offering. And then what our actual paid for tool, again, we've tried to make it more simple, which is, as soon as you pay us $10, you get everything. You then don't have to worry about your choices about what you do or don't need. And all those features are geared towards people who are trying to make money from their bookings. Very simple. People who are doing sales and recruitment and customer success. People who are, you know, who are scheduling time because this is their work. So it matters to them that they don't lose money or time if they miss the appointment, for example. So, you know, if they... they can get reminders, or if they can make sure that their client or their customer has picked the right time, and so on and so forth. So all of those kind of things really matter. Whereas in a lot of people who just have, you know, they're just trying to find a time to meet or show their availability, you know, and it in a way, what's the cost to them if they miss the appointment or if it doesn't work out or something like that? That becomes the gauge. And our experience is that businesses, companies, professional people, who are, you know, interested in using You Can Book Me to save them time and that hassle of back and forth. The hassle of the back and forth already costs them. So they want to pay for all the features that essentially lock down, you know, the entire scheduling nightmare that most people have.
Absolutely. You kind of already approached my next question, which is the onboarding process for a freemium user, because there is a few ways of product dynamics. One is credit card upfront and a free trial. The other is free trial, then the credit card prompt. And the other one is a freemium, where the person is forever on the free plan.
Right.
And the dynamics of the onboarding is totally different for all three cases. And for example, the first two, they totally focus on the first 14 days. They really kill the customer with their prompts, interest, and whatever. But in freemium, you have your life worth of time. At the same time, I get the spirit of beating a dead horse with my onboarding emails, because it all slows down with time as well as the interest does. What's your take on this?
So we have changed our initial, if you create an account with You Can Book Me, we default you to a 14-day free trial. Mm-hmm. If you want, opt out of that immediately and immediately just go onto the free plan. Now, if you do that, we take that as a fairly strong signal that you're not interested in paying us any money. So, you know, we obviously treat you differently. So, for example, people who are on the free version don't get access to in-app support. They can't contact the team. They don't get email support. We just have to stop trying to support users. But the quid pro quo is that we do send them emails inviting them to sign up to live webinars. There's a massive knowledge base. There's loads of FAQ and help tips on the thing. So our aim is to get people who signal to go onto the free tool to basically, you're on, you know, self-service. You've asked for this. So there you are, you know, and we send them nice emails, but we're not, you know, totally bothering them. And there is a certain proportion of people who from the free version of the tool will then actually realize that they in fact want to pay. And they can do, and there's prompts and there's, you know, indications on the UI around the place about what would be a paid for feature. If you're happy on the 14-day free trial, then yes, you are in a flow where we are expecting people who are essentially interested in paying, and they have no problem paying. They just need to find out whether it's right for them. And that's when we do give them more, we do give them more email support and in-app support and help them get set up, because ultimately, they are the ones potentially paying for the service that we're providing. So we focus on them. I mean, that's not to say that we don't answer tweets and emails if they get through. It's just that we've had to take a close dividing line of our time and resources go to the free, to the paid users, and the people indicating to us that they are. And so we did have a guy a while ago, and I don't know how we should react to this, but there was a guy who said, look, I only upgrade. He said he wanted a refund. He said, can I have a refund, please? I only upgraded because I wanted to contact support. So I realize, you know, actually the people who are prepared to pay, even if it's just $10, like if he had just upgraded for $10, got the support and then cancelled his subscription, I get that. You know, that's fine. That's good. That's sort of the system working. It's him acknowledging that it costs us. But at the same time, that kind of like, oh, I want a refund now, so I'm going to cost you twice as much. And I think that in a way, I feel sad that I've ended up more cynical than I, you know, 5 years ago, I was we were all super gung-ho for supporting free users. And now I realize we've just been worn down by it, and it doesn't really help us. But much more importantly, even if we end up doing support 24 hours a day, the worst thing you can do is tell your paying customers that the tool is slowing down. You can't roll out features. You can't improve anything, because basically the entire company's resources are being put into supporting free users. It's just not acceptable. You know, they're not paying for that. They're paying for us to support them. They're not paying for us to give that away to free users. So that's where our onboarding point of departure happens. When you tell us, I don't intend to pay for this software, I want a free tool, we say, okay, that's great, but this is the deal. You go off over there, have a nice time, but we are now here dealing with our paying customers. And I feel that I've had to be tougher with that attitude, because in the early years, we were so grateful that anybody used our tool. We didn't distinguish. And we're very nice and we're very British and we don't like to ask for money. But I've now realized, like, oh, our company's going to go out of business unless we ask for money. That's what we need to do. It's quite clear. And also you meet a whole load of software companies who are really good at asking people for money, and they make loads of money and they're very profitable and successful and they're very good at it. And I realized, like, God, man, you know, we have to be better at this, because we owe this to the people who do pay us money. And then sort of go back onto your question, then there's another part, which again, we did at the beginning, and I think it was more confusing than helped, which is that we allow people to enable a lot of paid for features to test them out, because we felt like, well, we'll let everybody try things.
Yeah, taste it.
But I don't think in the end, I think it's more philosophical than that. I think people who are willing to pay have always been willing to pay, and they just need to have a clear path to paying in terms of what software you're offering them. People who have no willingness to pay, who want the free version, putting all this, as I said before, all this stuff in front of them just confuses them and costs us more. So we're starting to split more and more, so that the free tool isn't, you know, trying to trip people up into thinking that they need to pay us, for example, because sometimes that's actually how people see it. And rather than like, oh, we let you try for free, actually people don't want to try for free. They just want to know what the boundaries are. And I think that it's not like, oh, I wanted to have the free tool, but now I've seen that you do multiple calendars, I'm now tempted to pay. It doesn't work like that. People who are prepared to pay, we're always prepared to pay. And they assume that all the features you're going to give them are the reason why. And I think also that you have a much clearer UI as a result, because it's very clear what's going on. It's labeled, you know, everything is labeled. Everything is hopefully more obvious. So we've been working on that a lot as well in the last year to make that more clear for people.
That's an amazing insight. So actually the purchasing dynamics remains the same as for a paid product, and people who want to pay will pay, and there is not much conversion, so-called conversion happening from free users. So your goal is to get the free customer base as free marketing and to really, really treat them separately with a simpler product. Am I interpreting you right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's what that's what we should have done in the first place, basically.
Mm-hmm. One thing I forgot to specify, you don't limit people on any kind of amounts of events or reminders or anything in your free plan. It's only the feature set, right?
We do on reminders, but not on bookings. No, not on actual taking bookings. You can, mm-hmm. you can take as many bookings as you like. What matters mm-hmm. is, you are only using one calendar. You have a sort of a much more fixed set of times that you can use. So we have a great feature called On Duty that allows people to specify custom times in their calendar that then are shown through on a booking grid. And you can't have that. So you have to have basically whatever is in your calendar blocking your times. And then you don't get reminders or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. So it is the feature set, not the numeral quantitative limits that you put on the free users.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Whoa. So that is a load of great information. Maybe a little bit more about, so the free users, you kind of leave them alone, and the paid ones usually convert from the start. That's what you are saying from
your
experience.
I think this is my experience, is that people who want to pay for software and they need a scheduling app, they try You Can Book Me, and maybe they've tried a few of our competitors as well, and they're looking for the right one. And as soon as they find the right one, they pay. And we support them, and we hopefully give them all the information that they need. And that's what, you know, that's what you're going for. And if you're using a free tool to try to promote your paid tool, know what your free tool is about. I think our early mistake was trying to imagine that it was all one great big, one great big natural progression from setting up a free account through to being a paying user. And what we've discovered is there's a difference between a free account and a free trial. And somebody who's on a free trial knows that there is an intention to pay at the end of it, and they just decide and evaluate whether it's right. Somebody who's just set up a free account, more often than not, has no intention of paying. But that's not to say that they're not very valuable users, and they might give us great feedback, and they'll help promote the pool and tool. And sometimes people will say the opposite of the guy that upgraded to get support and then requested a refund, other guys will email us to say, I love You Can Book Me, I love it, but I really don't need any of the paid for features. I'm very happy with what I've got, but I'd love to give you some money. Can I not just send you a check? And we've had more than one person email us something where and what we say often is to say, well, look, just give some money to charity, you know, an international charity, just make a donation in our name, that would be great. But you know, so some people are very passionate about You Can Book Me, but they don't pay us because the free tool is enough. Now, I think you just have to be careful that you don't give too much away. We did something a couple of years ago where we actually took a lot of features away from the free tool because we
realized, How did it feel when you did sell?
Well, we grandfathered existing users. So we don't generally grandfather price, but we do grandfather features. So often people have access to features that are no longer available on current plans. They have them. I mean, it's a whole different podcast, to be honest, Jane, to talk about migration and feature changes and grandfathering, because we've done years of it, because we've been around for so many years and we've realized where we've made mistakes. We've wanted to make changes. So as a result, we don't want to let down our existing users. So we generally grandfather them, or we tell them what's going on, and we give them the options of a choice or a deal of some kind of transition. But in this case, what we did was we turned off all of those features that were actually really good features, very difficult to support and getting in the way of a easy onboarding for free users, took them away. And I think we made in that month, we basically made just an extra £10,000 just in that month, just because people who otherwise would have used the free version just started to pay us.
Amazing. Amazing. Okay, Bridget, thank you so much for your insight. Where can people find you personally, and you can book me online?
So you can go to youcanbook.me is our website. Set up a free account. Having just said all of that, if you would like to have a free month on You Can Book Me, our free trials are 2 weeks, but I'm very happy to extend extra time on the paid for version for any of your listeners. So they just email team@youcanbook.me, and we will set them up with an extra upgrade on their accounts. I'd be very happy to do that. For me personally, I'm on Twitter, Bridget Today, @BridgetToday. And you can email me, Bridget@youcanbook.me, if you've heard this and you've got any questions. I'm very happy to answer anything or pick up on any questions.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. It was super valuable for me personally, and I'm sure for anybody else who is brainstorming a freemium option for their SaaS. Thank you once again.
Good luck, everybody.